The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
As for Master Dogen's Genjo Koan, Section 8. When the truth does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. When the truth fills our body and mind, we realize something is missing. For example, when we view the four directions from a boat on the ocean, where no land is in sight, we see only a circle and nothing else. No other aspects are apparent. However, this ocean is neither round nor square, and its qualities are infinite in variety. It's like a palace. It's like a jewel. It just seems circular as far as our eyes can reach at the time. The 10,000 dharmas are likewise like this. Although ordinary life and enlightened life assume many aspects, we only recognize and understand through practice what the penetrating power of our vision can reach. In order to appreciate the 10,000 dharmas, we should know that although they may look round or square, the other qualities of oceans and mountains are infinite and variety. Furthermore, other universes lie in all quarters. It is so, not only around ourselves, but also right here and in a single drop of water. I reversed the sections from last night and tonight. This is an earlier section than what I did last night. I thought last night's section worked better for Sotsu. Anyway, whatever. In case you're tracking. When the truth does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. When it fills our body and mind, we realize something is missing. Speaking of the truth is helpful and problematic because it seems to present a definitive truth that exists somewhere. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, a 15,000 line Subhuti is praising the Prajnaparamita and perfection of wisdom, the sutra and perfection of wisdom itself. And he says, for the own being of all dharmas, own being means existence, self-existence. For the own being of all dharmas is empty of the own being of all dharmas. It is thanks to the perfection of wisdom that the bodhisattvas, the great beings, know full enlightenment, although they do not fully know any dharma. They turn the wheel of dharma, but they do not turn any dharma forward or backward. They do not behold any dharma, nor do they demonstrate any dharma. And why? Because that dharma cannot be apprehended, which could turn forward or backward. For one absolutely does not settle down in all dharmas. Why? Because emptiness does not precede or recede, nor does the signless or the wishless. The own being of all dharmas is empty of own being. That emptiness is empty of emptiness. Dharmas are empty of truth. And so when Dogen says the truth does not fill our body and mind, when it does not, we think we have enough. This seems to go against what we would expect. That when the truth does not fill our body and mind, right, we would think that we would know that. We would know that we don't have enough. And even more, when it does fill our body and mind, then we realize something is missing. That seems wrong. When it fills the body and mind, we think we should realize that nothing is missing. So what is Dogen saying? You know, a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Think of the arrogance of youth. You know, we're young, we're coming of age, entering into sort of our growing adult-like, hormone-saturated body and mind, encountering new ideas, starting to make choices, feeling the surge of that energy, looking at our elders and thinking they just don't get it. I think back about situations and actions I took when I was young, thinking, I know enough. I know a lot, actually. I was remembering when I was about 15, with a friend of mine, we hatched this idea on spring break, which was in March. We were going to paddle a canoe down the Chattahoochee River, which goes from North Georgia down right into Atlanta and then dog legs to the west and heads over toward Alabama. So we were going to head up north, get in it, and paddle all the way down and spend the whole week doing that. He's my best friend. We camped a lot. And the fact that neither of us had even sat in a canoe did not really seem like a problem. Like, how hard could it be? I checked out a book, learned about the strokes. I told my parents that my friend Kelly was a pretty skilled canoeist. And he told his parents the same thing about me, and we just had to make sure our parents didn't talk to each other. They didn't. So we got my father to take us up. He dropped us off into the woods. It was almost dark. It was raining. We dragged the canoe down into the bush, to the woods. You know, we were sitting there trying to get a fire lit in the rain. And we both looked up at each other. And I said, "You hear that?" And he said, "Yeah." And it was the river, and it sounded like rapids. So, the arrogance of youth. But you know, it's a way to learn. It's a way to test your limits. It's a way to gain confidence. Dharma's not completely unfamiliar. We enter in, and we basically jump off into the deep end. In a sense, the moment we arrive and we're given beginner instruction and shown to our seat, we're in the deep end. The first session we do, we're definitely in the deep end. We're not ready, in a sense. We're not prepared. You can't be, right? The preparation that we need to have is to have some understanding, clarity about why we're here. Why are we doing this? In the Abhidharma teachings, arrogance is one of the mental afflictions or the unhealthy or obstructive mental factors. And arrogance is described as a self-satisfaction, being satisfied with ourself, but in a way that's not based in validity. It's a joy or a mental bliss that arises from attachments to any sign, I mean anything that we can glean that gives us a sense of good fortune. And then we inflate that in our mind into a sense of self-importance and status, being higher than others, superior. It says it assists and increases other mental afflictions, so it doesn't stand on its own, but it kind of supports and encourages other mental afflictions, so it kind of gathers together. It says it takes one's good fortune as a personal possession, right? Something good has happened, and we turn it into something. We inflate it, inflate ourselves with it. And while it appears to feel good, to be a positive, it increases other mental afflictions. And of course, the arrogance is of the self, the sense of self, that is becoming even more reified, more solidified, more substantial. Own being, something that has been in and of itself, by itself. And there's a dynamic, there's a tension in a way, because I remember talking to Chosen Roshi once. We were Zooming about some things. I don't know how he got onto this. And she said, you know, I don't remember exactly the words she said, but it was basically, you know, to practice and to think that you can, you know, realize yourself, that's kind of, you have to have some ego. You know, you have to have some chutzpah to do that. You have to be audacious to think you can do that. And so practice does and needs to and is supposed to build trust and confidence in ourselves. Not just a sense of stability, but resilience and clarity and stamina and perseverance, all of these good qualities that really are confidence building. You know, service positions, you're thrown into a service position. You know, over the years, every once in a while, somebody comes in and says, you know, it's just not fair. I was given this position. I wasn't given any instruction. I said, wait a minute. You weren't given any instruction? Not enough. I said, no, enough. And so in that, we're thrown into a situation we've never done before. It's public, right? You're on the spot. Mistakes are publicly made, right? And so we struggle and we do whatever we do with all of that. But the intention and the aim, and usually the outcome, is that we are building confidence. We're seeing that, oh, I can do that. I can do that and make mistakes. I can do that, make mistakes, and the world keeps turning, right? I'm not shown the door. The world doesn't collapse. And maybe I've noticed other people are making mistakes, and that seems to be okay too. And so insights, the things that naturally occur in practice, gaining understanding, shifts within and without, the development of our virtues, our good qualities, all of these naturally occurring events in practice can be mistaken as something special about me. In other words, we can take those experiences, which are really experiences that are helping us to move towards or have direct insight into selflessness, that there's nothing to inflate. Inflation itself is empty. And to reify that, solidify that self. And so it's particularly ironic when a person has direct insight into the nature of the self, that the self is empty, and then inflates that sense of selflessness. And so we can mistake that as being a sign that somehow we are special, not just because we're a human being, we have enlightened nature, that's pretty nice, but special above and beyond others. A sign of our uniqueness, of our triumph, of our accomplishment. And so it can lead to an elevation of the sense of self. When the truth does not fill our body and mind, we think we have enough. And so generally, I mean, you know, we can enter in with all kinds of little secrets about what we really want, but we'd most usually never utter them, you know, that are more self-centered. You know, we want to be enlightened and lead the world to peace. Or, you know, sometimes people call up and say, I'd like to find out what it is involved in becoming a teacher. You know, I mean, in a way, that seems like a natural question. You can call up other places and, I don't know, could you call up a corporation and say, what do I have to do to be the CEO? Probably wouldn't get you very far. But usually students set out with sincerity, right? And it happens along the way. There's a koan, I can't remember what, or a dialogue actually, where a student comes to realization about the emptiness of self-nature. And the teacher immediately responds to that by pointing them towards the 10,000 things. And the student says, please, teacher, can I just dwell here for a moment? And so we can take those experiences as possessions, appropriate them, build them into the house of the self. And so we keep training. We keep training. It's not a crime, right? It's not a sin. It's really doing what we have been doing throughout our lives, taking something, and if we want it, we integrate it, put it into this house, right, to build the house up. Sometimes people who leave, you know, with a little dharma in their belly, thinking, I got what I came for, thank you very much, I get it. And so to be sincere means to that we should be continually encountering what we don't understand, what we don't know, and whether it's understanding of the dharma or whether it's our ability to manifest it. I read a respected teacher that I respect recently who said that it's better to just remain just deluded in the everyday ordinary sense than to dwell in a false house of conceit. I thought that was very interesting. Because at least then it's just ordinary form delusion rather than being endowed with some special spiritual affect, which can be dangerous in a way, particularly if the person is charismatic and starts to attract others, and that's happened a lot. That's why in the Buddha's teaching and the monastic rules, there are five sort of, five transgressions that if you commit one of these, you fail. You have to leave the sangha. You can't remain in the sangha because they're so significant. Like murdering somebody, you know, significant. But one of them is to put forth spiritual qualities or experiences or powers that you don't have. And that's pretty interesting, alongside taking a life. And if you think about the effect that could have within a community, not just the person's own individual practice, but the effect that would have within a community, particularly if the person was charismatic, like Devadatta. So in the story that Shinji told, Devadatta, remember, was the king who would not
allow the Doe to live.
That's right. And so Devadatta was a cousin of the Buddha, and was powerful, you know, had some understanding and was personally had a charismatic, powerful being. And at one point came to the Buddha and said, you know, you've done a really good job, but it's really time for you to step down and let the next generation come in. And the Buddha said, no, and not you. And he didn't like that. And so it said that there were several ways in which he tried to take the Buddha's life. And so it can be problematic. I remember many years ago when we were struggling, and winter was a really difficult time, because there was a certain point at which programs and attendance became quite consistent. But in the early years, it was not like that at all. Winters were like, everything dropped. And it always seemed like it would snow heavily on a Friday. That's why I still go to the new register and I say, particularly on introductory weekends, I say, if anybody calls to cancel, just tell them, we don't accept cancellations. You have to come. But we used to do a program where we would send out flyers to colleges and encourage college students to come on their winter break. And, you know, for a few years that worked. And I remember one year we had a number of college students and there was a young woman. And she came for a month. And I think at the end of the first week, she'd had enough. She was not doing well and not enjoying it and did not want to be here. And then a couple months later, she sent us an article that she wrote in her college paper that was quite long about her glorious time at the monastery. And I thought, that's impressive. One, that she wrote it, and that she sent it to us. I thought, I don't quite know how all that works together, but you'll probably go far in this culture. I think it was Hogan Sensei talked about stories earlier in the week, and you know, during our anniversary celebration, we told lots of stories. We put together a book of stories. And so those stories, a story has no own being. It does not have a truth that resides within it in and of itself. It does not have its own power. And so it's more, what is the intention in the creation of the story? What is the story that's being told? How is it used? Is it to build up our pride? Is that why we put together that collection? This is how great we are. This is how far we've come. No. That certainly wasn't my intention. It wasn't our intention. Was it to encourage gratitude and appreciation? To help us to get a sense of what does it mean to tend the lamp? It sounds very poetic, but it's a nuts and bolts kind of thing. It's an everyday wake up and do it again kind of thing. And so with every day in practice, with any accomplishment, whatever that might be, what happens next? You go to your seat, sit down, and start again. And you see that there is more. There's more. See that what is realized is in everyone. It is nothing special in that sense. It doesn't distinguish one from another. It is special in the sense that it is transformative of life and has the power to open like a flower blooming. And so that's why our intention, there's so much in the teachings about our intention being pure, clean, clear, right? In accord with the Dharma, towards selflessness, not towards, you know, building ourselves up into something, to be free of self-clinging and to take that seriously. And to remember that self-denigration is the other side of this. You know, it's a deflated form of pride. It's a different kind of being special, being unique. And that can be a tricky thing to even say, because someone can take that who is inclined towards a lot of self-disparaging and use that against themselves. Oh, here's one more reason why I deserve to criticize myself, because even my self-criticism is a bad thing. And so we can think of just not indulging those kinds of thoughts, those inner stories, those habit patterns, as ceasing from harm, the first pure precept. And then a practice like the Four Immeasurables in the first person. May I know happiness and the root cause of my happiness. May I be free of suffering. May I rejoice in my own good qualities. May I abide in equanimity. And that in the Visuddhimagga, a student asked the Buddhaghosa, who's basically giving instruction in doing the Four Immeasurables in that way, and says, isn't that self-serving? Isn't that going against the Dharma because it's building up a sense of self? He said, no. Because what the person is doing with a sincere intention is they're showing themselves, they're providing an example of how one can do that practice and cultivate those virtues, so that then when they do it for others, they've experienced themselves how powerful that is. And it's an excellent practice for those who have an inclination towards self-criticism. And it can be done even if, as you're doing it, you don't fully believe in it. Dogen goes on to say, for example, when we view the four directions from a boat on the ocean where no land is in sight, we see only a circle, nothing else. No other aspects are apparent. But this ocean is neither round nor square. Its qualities are infinite, like a palace, like a jewel. It just seems circular, as far as our eyes can reach at the time. And it's a nice image, right? Because we can relate to that. If you've ever been out in the ocean where you couldn't see land, it's a circle all around you. And it is. And yet, it isn't. The ocean is not a circle. And yet, our experience of it in that moment is. It may be smooth on the surface, quiescent, like there's nothing going on, and yet underneath are worlds and worlds of activity and creatures and life. And so what he's saying, obviously, is when we view any aspect of the world from the boat of the self, from our memories and associations, expectations, certainties, biases, from thinking we have enough. We will see. We will have perceptions. They will seem objectively true. And we are only seeing what our limited mind allows us to see. When we know that, it's okay. When we don't know that, it's problematic. We can't see what we don't see, right? Wendell Berry has a book called The Age of Ignorance, and he talks about the fact that throughout human history, we have always, in every generation, every person, if they endeavor to, can continue throughout the whole of their life to learn something new that they didn't know before. And he said the implication of that is that we're always functioning with some degree of ignorance because we are always gaining more knowledge, more understanding. And so then he asks, how should we proceed knowing that we are always abiding within some state of ignorance? And we don't know what we don't know. We don't know the extent of that ignorance. We don't know how significant it may be not knowing what we don't know. He said, how should we proceed? And he said, with humility. Rather than thinking that we know, or it doesn't matter that we don't know, like spending a week going down the river, is like, we'll figure it out, right? Whatever happens, we'll figure it out, which is, you know, kind of a youthful joie de vivre, you know, spirit, and a little bit of recklessness. And you just hope it works out, right? And don't let your parents know too much. There were so many times where, like me and my brother, we'd be talking about something that we were up to when we were young, and my mother would be sitting there with this puzzled look on her face and saying, where was I when all this was happening? And we would say, far, far away. The statute of limitations had run out, so. We don't see what we don't see. Not seeing anything more, it can appear as though there's nothing more to see. Experiencing Zazen as we are, it can appear that there's nothing more to Zazen than this. That's one of the reasons Sesshin is so important. Because we sit beyond what we would normally do on a daily basis. And we will very often have experiences that we have not had before. Subtle ones, slight ones, more significant. And so what that's showing us over and over again is that whatever our present experience is no limit. And when we do that everywhere else, when we reduce a person, an idea or a situation, a creature, a practice, a teaching, to our own confined view, I understand it this way, that's it. I've chanted this sutra before. Why do I have to chant it again? We don't see that we are confining ourselves. And so that's why it's so important to actually practice. Sometimes people will come in and say, okay, you know, I've sort of got the hang of things. What's next? It's like, start over. You're doing it, but you're not doing it yet. Do it. I remember a Dharma acquaintance who was running a prison group at Sing Sing. And because we'd been doing it a long time, we were consulting, and I went down there. He asked me to go down and do an all-day sit because he couldn't do it. So I went down and led it. And there were some curious things that they were doing, and they weren't doing any liturgy. And I talked to him later. I said, why don't you do any liturgy? He goes, because, you know, once you do it and then you do it again, it just, you stop paying attention to it. And I said, so you just flushed it? Like, that's the way you solve that problem? Curious. And that's one reason it's so important to hear the teachings over and over again from realized beings to strengthen our faith. To hear again reports from within, reports from beyond. Dogen says the 10,000 things are also like this, like a jewel, like a palace. It seems circular as far as our eyes can reach, but its qualities are infinite. The 10,000 dharmas, which means every blessed thing, anything you can see or hear or taste or smell or touch or think. And because the 10,000 dharmas are likewise like this, we bring our bright, clear Buddha mind to the 10,000 things, one moment at a time. The breath, awareness, koan, a thought, a sensation, a memory, a sound, the breeze across your face. And in that moment, leap out of the boat of the self, rather than turn that into the boat itself, and see just this that is before me. One breath, one cessation, one thought, without a name, before it's named, because the name brings the whole thing, the whole package along with it. Once we identify it and name it, we know it, it's done, it's fixed. To not see it as a thing. Don't see it as many things. Don't create a circle. Don't create a palace or a jewel. Rest. Finally, rest. Although ordinary life and enlightened life assume many aspects, we only recognize and understand through practice what the penetrating power of our vision can reach. And I would echo Da Wei. He said it about birth and death, but I would say to take this line and paste it, write down on a piece of paper and then paste it on the end of your nose. Right? We should all do that. Like right after the talk. Another translation says, we see and understand only what is reached by the strength of the eye of study. We can only see what the power of our current vision can reach. So in a sense, there's the capacity of the present, our present awareness. And then there's our ultimate capacity, which is so much more. And so we have to, in a sense, practice with our present capacity, because that's what we see, that's what we are working with, while knowing that that is limited. And that is a wonderful thing to hold together, right? Because then you're meeting the reality of this moment as it is, accepting it and working with it, being skillful, but also having a sense. It's sort of like being mindful in this moment, moment to moment, right? But also having a sense of the arc of the path, so that the moment to moment awareness doesn't become myopic and narrow, but we don't get lost in the large arc. They work together. What can I not see? What am I not seeing? What is it that I don't yet know? And the idea is, don't speculate. Just don't know. Don't know. And begin to become comfortable with that. That does not have value in our culture, right? What we value is having the answers, knowing your stuff better. Don't know. And don't know can be just knowing that we don't know. I encounter Dogen, I encounter other teachings, I don't really know what they're saying. I don't really understand this Dharma. And so we engage, we study, we practice that. It becomes clear. And then there's a much deeper not knowing, which is much, much more difficult. Much of the time, don't know is one of those things that we can sort of bandy about. But most of the time, not knowing is being mistaken as just another form of knowing. Or knowing is being mistaken as not knowing. In order to appreciate the 10,000 dharmas, we should know that although they may look round or square, the other qualities of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Furthermore, other universes lie in all quarters. It is so not only around ourselves, but also right here and in a single drop of water. You know, these studies that have been done and books that have been written by people who've really been studying the world of different creatures, right? Who see, not with eyes, but in other ways, who hear, taste, experience their world using other organs of perception. That they literally live in a different world than we do. It's the same world, but it's not the same. And then when we think about that as just in the human realm, right? That we can all be experiencing what seems to be the same thing, objectively. I'm experiencing this. I see you are looking at it too. We're having the same experience, and we're not. Our mind consciousness is not clear and clean. It brings our karmic streams, mind streams, beliefs, ideas, associations, our biases. And the fundamental bias we have is towards the self. And so it makes sense that we would become prideful, we would could easily become arrogant, because it's a building up, but now in a good way, a special way, an enlightened way. And so, again, it's not a crime, it's just to be alert. Dr. Rusha just used to say to me a lot, the things that occur to you. Okay, he did. He said, don't believe in your own press notices. I never really thought about whether it was speaking, he was speaking specifically and uniquely to me. Did he ever say that to you?
He was speaking specifically.
Thank you. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about the Dharma is we don't have to be afraid. We don't have to be afraid that this might arise or I might fall into this mindset or this emotion or this whatever. We don't have to be afraid. Just take refuge in your practice. Know how to practice. And do it. And then all of that energy that goes into thinking or worrying or being concerned or freaking out because, oh, I thought I'd taken care of that, and there it is again. As though it shouldn't. As though something that we let go of goes somewhere else or is just annihilated. Rather than just becoming more recessed in our consciousness, not so fertile, not so easily reactive. But it doesn't go anywhere because it's not something. And so can it arise again? But don't worry. Just know how to meet it. And Bendoa Dogen says, all Buddha Tathagatas who individually transmit inconceivable Dharma, actualizing unsurpassable complete enlightenment, have a wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned. Receptive samadhi is its mark. Only Buddhas transmit it to Buddhas without veering off. Sitting upright, practicing Zen, is the authentic gate to free yourself of the unconfined realm of this samadhi. Although it's abundant in each person, it is not actualized without practice, and it is not experienced without realization. We have to step forward. All Buddhas continuously abide in this Dharma and do not leave traces of consciousness where they are. Sentient beings continuously move about in this Dharma as well, but where they are is not yet clear in their consciousness. Not yet clear. This wondrous art has been given to you, received by you, to each of us. We call it sitting Zen and walking Zen and bowing and eating Zen. Losing faith and starting again. Zen, faint-hearted and courageous. Zen, turning inward and turning outward, saving yourself and saving others. Veering off and returning. We may not yet know, not yet be clear, that we are moving about in this Dharma. Because we move about in this Dharma continuously, it is never absent, we are never apart. This means there's never a moment that we cannot practice. It means you are never the person who is lacking what is needed to practice. It means that you are finally meeting the person that you have been seeking to show you the way. How good is that?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.